Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Marie Helene Bertino here in the studio joining me today for the program. Marie, thanks for being here.
Hi, T. It's such a delight to be here in your beautiful studio with you today. Thanks for having me.
It's got a charm of its own.
It really does. I love it so much, and I kind of never want to leave.
Well, you then welcome, and you're meant to be here, because I think sometimes some of us never do leave, so be careful what you say.
I get that impression. I'd like to be the coffee girl around here. I can bring really good coffee.
Oh my gosh, that often happens during fundraiser when we are like, we need a tank of coffee. So, but thanks also, before we get too far away from the opening song by Philip Glass, mm-hmm. thanks for picking the songs for today's program. And could you say, you know, well, we're here to talk about your novel, your latest book out this January, right?
That's
January
right.
2024, mm-hmm. Beautyland, with FSG. Philip Glass, mm-hmm. why that song to start us off?
So many reasons. Beautyland is about a woman who believes that she is extraterrestrial and here on Earth to take notes on human beings that she sends to her superiors on a planet 300,000 miles away via fax machine. And when I was thinking of what she would be obsessed with on Earth, I knew it would be music because she's so mathematically inclined. And to me, and to a lot of people, and I mean, this has been written about extensively, music is, you know, kind of how math expresses itself and sings. And when I thought about what musician she would become obsessed with, the repetition of Philip Glass made a lot of sense to me. It would be soothing to her. She has misophonia, and Philip Glass's kind of ecstatic repetition, I felt like, would be very calming to an ear like Adina has. Also, Adina is takes her name from a dear friend of mine, Adina Telvey Goodman, who we lost a few years ago. And we were both fans of Philip Glass. And there was a moment where I hit a wall hitting Beautyland, and it was just too hard. I was in some pretty profound grief after Adina passed away. And I was in a workout class, actually, and it was like the end of a workout class where they put beautiful music on and you lay on the ground and they say sweet things to you. And you just think, I can't believe I just did that and I'm exhausted, but this is really nice. And the workout instructor was saying, you know, the beautiful end monologue. And then that song started playing. And I had been thinking, like, Adina, I don't think I can do it. I don't think I can write this book. I just don't think I can do it. And that song started to play, and I don't know what I believe about signs from the other side, but in that moment, I was like, oh my gosh, okay, I hear you. I'll keep trying. And that song presses a lot of buttons in me. Even as you were just playing it, I was like, oh God, I'm going to start this interview off by crying.
Same. How's everyone doing out there?
That's Philip Glass's fault, not mine.
True. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. I'm so sorry for your loss of your dear friend Adina and a fellow writer.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And
yeah, thank you. She was writing nonfiction when she passed away, and she was
about her illness.
That's right. That's right. So Adina was born with a single ventricle heart and spent a life that was very much marked in its depths by illness and disability. And so she was writing about that when she passed away in really remarkable and beautiful ways. So it's nice that we have some of those essays now.
And there's something like that that also makes you feel other in the world when you have an illness or like a single ventricle heart,
yeah.
where a part of what I also love about Beautyland is many things to talk about with you, Marie, mm. but like the imagination, the playfulness, but the pathos, the real heart in it, and loss and grief, because grief is such a part of Beautyland. And just talking with you now, there's ways that like a writer's lived experience, even though this is a book of imagination, the lived experience seems to now maybe feel throughout it as well.
Oh, it's absolutely stitched with real feeling that comes, that is sourced, I would say, from my actual life, for sure. I teach my students that I do not believe that fiction is a lie. I've never really liked that. That description has never really matched how I feel. I like to borrow, I think it's the Meisner School of Acting's definition of acting, which is telling the truth under imaginary circumstances. And that's exactly how I feel about writing fiction. I am telling the truth as hard as I can, even when I'm writing about aliens, vampires, unicorns, things that people believe don't exist, but that I deeply believe in.
And it's also about finding the truth. Like, what is it you believe?
Absolutely. Yeah. Using stories, using poems, using novels to figure out how you feel about things in very real ways, hopefully.
Without Adina's Lost, would Beauty Land have a different arc, do you think? Or,
well, it definitely wouldn't have included certain scenes because I wouldn't have been thinking about them particularly, but I had already been writing Beauty Land, and though my extraterrestrial woman borrows her name, it's more based on my actual life. And so the events were already in place from my life. But after I lost Adina and I lost my dog suddenly in the middle of the night, and a few things happened over the course of writing Beauty Land that worked their way into the novel in what felt like organic ways.
Sorry, I was thinking of something else completely, and I didn't know that, because then as soon as you said I lost my dog, I flashed to scenes with Butternut,
who's a
character in the book.
Yeah, Butternut is based on my dog, Fantastic Mr. Fox. He was my first rescue dog and the other half of my heart, and I lost him while I was actually away teaching. I was away for work, essentially, and he... hopefully, very peacefully, we lost him in the middle of the night. And so I had been thinking about what it's like to miss someone and what it's like to be there for someone, perhaps more importantly, while they're here, and what shape that could take. And so, yeah, many of those things worked their way in, and just love of animals. You know, love of friends, love of sisters, love of vocation, and the act of writing these things down and taking notes and noticing what you're noticing, and making that kind of invisible practice visible for yourself, so that you're thinking and feeling throughout your day, and you're staying awake as much as you can.
Is that part of how you believe, like, living as a writer, what that means?
I do. I think that writing is pretty much everything. I can't think of much that I wouldn't say is writing. And so when people ask me things like, should I write for 2 hours a day? Like, what does a writer do? Like, to be a writer, what do I have to do? And I think,
like, what's the minimum?
What's the recipe? Just tell me what to do. And I wish there was just a list of five things that you could do, and that would automatically equal being a writer. But the only thing I can come up with that consistently is there for me is walking around, noticing, and trying to become conscious of those things on the everyday. And in that way, there is no such thing as writer's block, because talking about writing is writing, and gathering is writing, and taking your mom out for dinner is writing, and planting a garden, raising a child, helping an elder, all of these things are, to me, writing. And so there is never a day that goes by where I feel like I haven't written in some way. but perhaps I have a very generous and broad idea of what that might mean.
No, I'm with you, Marie. I feel the same way sometimes.
I'm glad.
Worrying that, there hasn't been, like, I haven't been writing a particular poem or something like mm-hmm. this, like in a shape. Mm-hmm. But I think it's something about the way of being in the world too, and this noticing. And do you have notebooks or do you use a fax machine like the character Adina does, or what's your method for like walking around, and then when you kind of bring back these observations or notes?
I think my method is ever evolving and ever expanding, and I try to pay attention to what I need in phases of my life. So I go through phases where, for example, just to get into the nitty gritty, I write in bed, I write in the morning, or I have to write at night, or the only thing I can do is write one sentence every week. And that's totally enough for me. But I find, like you said, not getting too down on yourself when you're not writing every day, or, you know, you're not writing that poem every day. I find that when you do return to it, even if it's been, you know, a quote-unquote long time, you have gathered. You're smarter than you were. You have been noticing. You have been thinking through it, so that when you return to it, it's like you know more than you should out of proportion with the amount of time that has passed. I think if you're just thinking through it, if you just assign it to your subconscious, I think you're always kind of working on it.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of thinking about it, too.
Do you find that, too?
I don't know that I've ever thought of it like that. So I'm going to try to have that level of like awareness, I think. But what I do know and take hope in is that feeling of being sort of suddenly in it and then lost in it. Mm-hmm. And then all this time, whatever time you're allowed to be there, could just be hours. And if you have that much time, you can be there in it. It goes. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes you're pulled back into the world for other things, potentially.
Absolutely.
To your responsibilities or what you're going to do.
Right. And I've just recently figured out, or have decided perhaps, that the things that pull you out of the writing, I've decided they are not writing. They are also the writing. So I've just welcomed them into my apparently ever-growing definition of what writing is. Yeah. I think perhaps I'm just like making an enormous excuse and trying to do it in a really articulate way. But the things that pull you out of the writing, I've decided, oh, you're the writing too. Hello, you're the writing. You're also the writing. And so, I think it's a way of being kind to the inevitable interruptions that are going to happen, so that you don't get so angry that you are unable to write for longer than you would have, you know, in that scenario.
Right. Right, because taking things as material and things that change you, like you said, you're different. You maybe know more than you would think you would know, even at that time, for the time spent away. I love that, but thinking about it like that.
Yeah. My mom told me once, many years ago, that she realized that she had been working on her tennis stroke in dreams, and mm-hmm. she...
This is a real thing.
Without even realizing it, she was working on her backhand. her backhand. I don't know what else she was working on. But she said she got better. She definitely got better after those dreams when she was meticulously. And I thought, yeah, okay, that makes sense. You can assign something to your subconscious and get better without realizing.
And did she mean to do that? She's like, I'm going to dream tonight about tennis. Or did it just happen and she could remember it?
Yeah.
I love that idea.
Yeah.
Let's all think more about our dreams.
I think we can borrow that. Yeah.
I've had it happen in slightly nightmare situations. Like when I was a brewer and I was very nervous about brewing. I was brewing in like my dream, like the different steps of it. But
oh, wow.
I love
the... But that was anxiety?
I think it was anxiety, but mm-hmm. I hope now I'd like to think it made me better. And I love that your mom's backhand was better.
I
just think that is okay. Well,
yeah,
now
my dreams are useless. My dreams are the anxiety kind too. When I remember them, it's normally like a giant bug trying to run after me. And yeah, I dream a lot about roaches because I'm terrified of them. And that's the one fear I can't really get rid of. I live in New York, so I'm in constant fear of a roach running up a wall. And one time I saw such an enormous one while I was making a pizza that I turned and tried, and just without even thinking, turned and immediately tried to run through a wall, essentially. And my partner said there was like a Marie-sized shape on the wall, as if I was trying to run through it like Bugs Bunny. And I dislocated my shoulder. So roaches are scary and they're dangerous.
Oh my gosh.
They are harmful for your health.
Oh
so
my gosh.
Yeah, I tend to dream about those little guys.
Yeah, and then in real life, spatial relations. Oh no. Marie, let's take a short break and then we'll be back.
Okay.
Today on Living Writers, Marie Helene Bertino is here. Her novel, Beautyland, out this year with FSG. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass and we'll be back.
I need the ginger tea.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, so glad you did. Today on Living Writers, Marie Helene Bertino is here in the studio. Her novel, Beautyland, is here on the table with us.
And Yoko Ono is in the studio, too.
Thanks to Jason for
it. Thank you.
And thanks to you for picking it, Marie.
Oh, it's the best.
So as soon as the opening, like her voice, the notes, you had two fists up in the air. Like, what's this mean? What's Yoko mean to you today?
So I just want to tell your listeners that this song is called No One Can See Me Like You Do. Ooh, ooh, ooh. And it's her with Apples in Stereo. I believe it's from her album that's called I'm a Witch. And it's just, I think it's just her with all these cool bands. I could be wrong about that. Please don't write into the station if I am. Likely I am. And I I just think she's making such a beautiful sound with Apples in Stereo. I think just the music is so beautiful and her lyric is so beautiful. No one can see me like you do. No one can love me like you do. And then she flips it. No one can see you like I do. No one can love you like I do. It's really simple. It's really beautiful. And Yoko Ono has a huge part of Beautyland because I was able to work in some of perhaps my own feelings about how Yoko Ono has gotten short shrift for a very long time because people have unfairly maligned her, and she is just such a cool artist. And I'm a Yoko Ono girly for life.
And when did that start for you, Marie? Because I think there are moments, because I feel like when I was a kid, I was like, who broke up the Beatles? Mm-hmm. Like these, it feels like an urban legend or something like that. Like, yep. But also it's just part of a misogyny, you know, themes of culture, you know.
1,000,000%. And I feel like this is a joke, but one time I thought my life is actually kind of separated into growing up and before I understood that blaming Yoko Ono for the Beatles breakup was a patriarchal, misogynistic, ridiculous nonsense, and after. And realizing that she was actually like the true artist and such an enormously amazing soul that just this Beatle made the mistake of falling in love with. And I credit actually poets for showing that to me, because I grew up around a lot of musicians who had a lot of opinions about the Beatles. And then I moved to New York City and started to hang out with poets, my partner being chief among them. And he was like, he introduced me to the art of Yoko Ono. Mm-hmm. And the poets are like 15 steps ahead of all of us, you know, on any given day, but certainly about things like, you know, breaking patriarchal and misogynistic structures in society. And that was one they definitely broke for me, and I will always be grateful for that.
And did that happen when you went to did you move to New York City for the MFA program? Is that what happened? Or did you move there before and met up with the poets?
That's kind of what I did. I was like, I'm going to New York City and I'm going to find the poets. I kind of did do that for that reason, to find the poets, because I had failed as a poet. I grew up wanting to be a poet. And when I was 25, I was rejected by every great MFA program for poetry. And it was really a crossroads and for me. And I was devastated. And I thought, okay, well, if I can't be a writer, then I'm just going to move to New York City and be around them. And my partner introduced me to St. Mark's Poetry Project, St. Mark's Church. That is his literal church and his family. And he started taking me to events there. And it's just such a profoundly special place. And then while I was there, the first year or two I was there, I found a writer's group on Craigslist, actually, a fiction writer's group. And I said, well, I'm not a writer anymore and I can't write, but I'd love to join you and I'll read your writing and help you with your writing, but I can't write fiction. And they said, well, why can't you try fiction? And I said, well, because to write fiction, you have to be male, and you have to have gone to war, and you have to have shot
like
a rhino.
Hemingway.
Exactly. I had this very strange opinion of what a fiction writer
you
needed to be.
You might not have even known you had that opinion. It might have just been from high school, you know, literature. I don't know. Yep. I think they're very different nowadays. But
I hope so. I hope so. / I'm not sure. But yeah, it's as ingrained as the Yoko Ono thing. Mm-hmm. You are just told these things, or you're shown these things. This is why representation matters.
It does.
Because when you read nothing but old white men and you're told this is literature, then you think, well, then I am not literature, clearly, and I do not have a seat at this table. And you believe it. I mean, up to age 25, and I said that to them. And they said, wow, okay, you're wrong. Read here. And they gave me books to read. And they gave me George Saunders and Yoko Ogawa and Haruki Murakami and Amy Bender, Amy Hempel, all
yes,
the Amys.
Yeah.
And I realized I just hadn't read contemporary fiction. And I think that is such an enormous thing as well. And I credit them. That's the Blackout Writers Group. with showing
out.
Me
shout out to Blackout Writers Group,
my very first friends in New York City, and they showed me contemporary fiction, and they're the reason. And when I realized you could be weird and funny and strange, I thought, oh, not only do I now understand I might have a seat at this table, but I think this is actually really what I'm on the earth to do. And that's when I was kind of bitten by this bug, and I was like, well, that's the rest of my life ruined, because I'm never going to want to do anything else. And that has turned out to be the case.
And thank goodness, because that's why Beautyland is in the world. You know, this imaginative, beautiful story.
Yeah.
And so, weird, funny, and strange. Were your poems weird, funny, and strange? Or did you think poems had to be a certain way?
Oh, that's such a good question. No, my voice was definitely in my poems. That's why they were so bad. But
no.
That's why they didn't work as poems, but they did tend, they actually translated better into like first person fiction. I think the stories in my first collection, Save as Houses, are good examples of what I'm talking about. That voicey kind of, this is how I feel about the world type thing.
Well, I even wondered about, because your prose itself is so lyrical, and how you structure things, I was noticing with the asterisks, especially at different parts, at different sections, the sections get shorter, some of them, where I think, oh, you can see how you're using space and movement in a way that not all novelists do. So that
I guess that's probably true. I wanted to write a book of vignettes because I love vignettes so much. And people hate vignettes. And I like them even more because people hate vignettes. You know, Joyce
Take
Carol
the fight
Oates.
To them.
Yeah. Exactly. take the fight to the page. You know how Joyce Carol Oates kind of infamously called them wan little husks?
No, I did not know she said that.
Yeah.
Oh, JCO, why?
JCO. But it's kind of, I don't know, it makes me laugh. It's kind of darling how people can hate a form, you know? But I love the form. I love what it does to the page. I love the whites, the negative space around it. And I love that you can look at a page and kind of, without even hearing the words, kind of know how it will sound just by the negative space. That's almost like you can read it like
music.
Music, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And so I wanted to write a book of vignettes, and it ended up really serving Adina's story well, because they are, I guess, in a way, transmissions of their own.
You know what? Maybe let's take a short break now. Listen to your next song pick that Jason has for us and Behind the Glass. And then do you mind reading when we come back so we can hear a bit of Beautyland?
Oh, yeah.
And then,
happy to.
And hear kind of some music from the page. Today on Living Writers, Marie-Helene Bertino is here. Her novel, Beautyland, on the table with us. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers, and we'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. Today, here in the studio, Marie-Helene Bertino is here, her novel, Beautyland. So, Marie, DJ for a day, why did you pick, what's this, why this song, and what's its connection to Beautyland?
So, Black Sheep, This or That, is very special to the book because Adina, in her grade school years, and Beautyland is Adina's entire lifespan, and it is separated, I should say, into five different eras of her life that take their names from the era of the life cycle of a star. So there are five eras in the life cycle of a star, and there are five eras in Adina's life. I can hear my Philadelphia accent so profoundly when I say the word era, and I'm sorry to your listeners.
No, are you kidding? I love that. Accent.
Oh my gosh.
Don't you love this the story? Your voice is a story of you. I think it's brilliant.
I like that. Thank you. Yeah, my voice is definitely a story for sure. During the pandemic, I was knocked back to my factory settings and my Philly accent came out. I wonder if that happened to anyone else. The Philly accent that was like long dormant came out and I just can't stop it anymore and I'm just not even going to try. Anyway, so I was saying, in her seventh grade, Adina takes up with these popular girls who all have J names and they're all hip hop dancers and they invite her to dance with them. And Adina is so, so, so excited to dance with them. And they dance, they do a choreographed dance to this song, Black Sheep's This or That. And then something totally unexpected and awful happens just as Adina is about to
take the stage,
reach her glory with these J girls. But the piece I thought I would read for you today actually is toward the end of the book and in the last era of Adina's life that's titled Black Hole. And she makes a list of her favorite things on Earth, her favorite small things on Earth, things that she would miss if she were to leave. And I thought, what I've really loved about touring with this book is that I can kind of match, since she writes about everything on Earth, I can kind of match what I read with who I'm reading for and where I'm reading. And so I like to read this section when I'm traveling because I'm always really aware of like the granular when I'm traveling and everything becomes like very visceral and vivid and upfront.
Yes.
So yeah, I thought I would read her list, which I think works autonomously and hopefully you will all enjoy. The moan humans make when they listen, especially when another human confides a painful feeling. Anything over rice. When a human asks another human running late if they'd like them to order a drink so it's there when they arrive. Thin tomato slices dusted with oregano. Dominic, when he was left out of things, like passing the joint, used to say, "What's my name, Skip?" The moment of silence under an overpass when driving in a storm. Control top pantyhose. The rose bushes behind the mobile station that bloom like they're in Versailles. The ripples in my hair after sleeping in a braid. Going to see a movie in bright afternoon and emerging when it's night. The word yet, because it allows you to believe more than one thing. Yolanda Kay, pretending to dance on top of a pyramid, waving a yoga mat like a cape, doing Diana Ross. The dog in the park, in the sun, catching the ball and bringing it back, flashing between his people like a gem. The night Tony said, "Let's wear our weather earrings and go to Whole Foods and say things like, 'I just love ramps, don't you?'" Fridays on the subway, when suitcases spring up like violets as people leave, as people arrive, then again on Monday as people return, as people leave. I have never lost my beginner's eye for the city, never stopped looking at the skyline when the 7 emerges from the tunnel for the above ground stops. My little dog standing on his hind legs, dancing. Wine, blankets, and robes, because they take away the body. A body is a hard thing to have. I was sent here to report on the human experience, and I have failed. I haven't used my life enough. Even the word itself, human, means flawed. It means everything is technically correct, but some unanticipated trouble has fouled it up. So if the assignment had been to be human, to fail, then I succeeded. But if it was to create a comprehensive document of life on Earth, I was always doomed. Language is pitiable when weighed against experience, and my deepest loves and sadnesses fell outside the realm of articulation and never reached the fax machine. There was always an unattainable aspect to my work, which they must have known. Otherwise, they would have sent someone less sensitive. There is no way of succeeding or failing that the word human doesn't allow.
Thank you, Marie.
Thank you.
Thank you for choosing that part to read, because I know sometimes it's unusual to read towards the end of a novel too, because yeah. Some people are like, don't talk about anything after this part. But with that part, you can hear the lyrical quality of it, and it can make sense on its own, like you said, autonomously, but in its placement in the novel, things that you wouldn't expect are brought back. Like, I think one that stood out to me in this moment was the control top pantyhose, because I immediately flashed to Adina's mom.
That's right.
And so these moments where you're thinking, they don't always have these missing qualities for Adina, since you've been with her lifespan, like you said, in the novel. At the time, Adina didn't want her mom to be wearing these. For example, one of the things I'm remembering is wearing them on the beach. I think she was wearing them on the beach, and she was like, why are you still wearing those? I'm going to go for a walk, so I'm not near you on this public beach, you know.
They were embarrassing to her, yeah.
But then in this moment later on, as we're in this final section, the black hole, which is subtitled Death, and Adina knows it's coming, it changes. Those are the things she's going to miss.
Absolutely. Like,
and missing being the flawed parts of what it is that means. Yeah.
It's amazing what you miss when the door is closing. Absolutely. And the things that you thought you were embarrassed by, or the things you thought were so horrendous and horrible and flaws, and are the things that, you know, endear you to other people and endear you to yourself in some cases. And I wish that I could read the end of Beautyland. I love, to be honest, I love the, this is a hard, maybe I shouldn't say this.
No, say it.
I love the end of Beautyland. Yes, I love the end of Beautyland, and I can never read from it because it gives too much away. And I've tried to figure out, oh, maybe I can read this section and that's, but I can't. And I don't want to take away anyone's reading experience.
That's why I purposefully didn't. I have a heart here, and I was like, well, we can't talk about these lines or these. Yeah.
I know. I come against it too. So I've read mostly from the first four sections, but I deeply, one day, maybe for a book group or something, if people have already read the whole book, we can talk about the ending. Because I don't read too much about Beautyland online, but I do know enough to know that there are some pretty wild thoughts about the ending, and some people believe very deeply in opposing ideas about what happens at the end.
What's it like for you as the author of Beautyland when you, because you were brave enough to look at what people are saying, But what is it like for you to think, oh, people are kind of taking these things? Because this is, Beautyland is its own thing in the world. Like, mm-hmm. right? It's, mm-hmm. what is that like?
Oh, man, it's amazing. It's, I can't believe it. I cannot believe that I have a novel out in the world at all in the first place. Like, I can't, I'm never going to get over it. I'm never going to get over it. I don't care. I plan to write more. I have another book coming out next year, but I'm never going to get over it. This is amazing. I still think about it. And I was coming here to Michigan and I said to my partner, I had this folder of my itinerary and I was like, look at this. I have an itinerary. Like, someone printed out an itinerary for me to do. Let's not lose sight of how bananas this is. You know, I don't want to ever feel like, oh yeah, this is no big deal. I'm never going to try to pretend that it's not a big deal, because it is an enormous deal to me. Mm-hmm. And it always will be. And it is an honor to be read, period. That if anybody reads my book, I am delighted. And I don't read about it online, but I've been told that they're big. So I don't want to. I also don't want to indirectly say anything that is actually not true. But I don't read about Beauty because I can't quite do that. But the fact that anyone has opinions about the end, that's cool. I really like that
because it means people also care so much about the world that you've created.
Yes.
Adina, the character that you've created. How did Adina, like, well, for Beautyland, what was, like, was there an image? How did the novel start? Because was it a particular vignette that you wrote? Or how did Beautyland have its, what's its origin story? If you,
it probably sounds strange, but I'm.
Was it a fax? No.
I was working in an office and a fax came in. Yeah, I mean, I've worked in a lot of offices with a lot of fax machines. And I think that it was... So the thing that I was going to say is that it's beginning to get a little blurry of how, like, the very, you know, the particular things, like the steps that led into this finished product now. But I do know that I had been taking notes for a very long time about humans, because I think I always thought that human behavior was strange and kooky, and many times it seemed like humans acted directly in opposition to how they felt or what they believed, and I never understood that. And so I started writing it down, and just as something that amused me. But that came from, you know, a long-held confusion I had with the world. And I used to collect copies of Alice in Wonderland because I very much felt like Alice in Wonderland walking around, who was just, no matter what she encountered over and over again, she maintained this eternal surprise with everything. And she just never learned. She was just always, oh my gosh, I can't believe this crazy thing is happening. And I was like, why doesn't she learn? Like, she's in this wild world. But in many ways, I think I related to her, because I often felt the same way, that things that people seemed to just effortlessly know how to do or how to handle just came a little harder to me. And I think one thing I do share with Adina is that hypersensitivity. And that has not always been great, but writing has been a way that I've been able to work through those things and write them down and show them to myself and think, okay, well, if I can write it down on the page, it can't be that bad.
And so for Adina, so it seems like it started with this character. How did you know that there was going to be, like, we'll start from the birth scene then? Did it make sense to build a chronology so that you felt like you would have this life arc for her?
Yeah.
Like you said, the sections of the book or...
Mm-hmm. It's funny because I worked as a biographer for a few years of people living with traumatic brain injury. And I worked for a plaintiff's attorney, and he represented people who had been normally pretty seriously injured in car accidents and on-the-job accidents. And my job was to tell their life story in these narratives to help present their case in court. And I learned when I was writing these narratives that unless there was a particular reason not to, that emotional resonance normally built over chronology a little more effectively. And so I started wondering, I wonder if I could tell someone's entire life story in a novel. And I think those two things collided. These notes I had been taking and the desire to write someone's entire life story. I think the first three books I wrote were kind of me gathering tools, gathering courage, gathering confidence to then take on someone's entire life. So I also feel like they were steps into Beautyland too.
Gathering tools.
Yeah. They were diagnostic.
Yep. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And gathering confidence.
And gathering
to
confidence.
Do something as ill-advised and hard. You know, Beautyland often felt like an impossible book to write. And I had to kind of wrestle with that impossibility. Like, how are you going to do this? And there were many moments during the writing of it where I thought, are you really, really going to try to pull this off? Are you really, really? And I had to double down on my devotion to it. And there were gut check moments. And because I write the way I do speculatively, I tend to always have these moments, these dark moments of the soul where I have to either commit to the premise or give it up in a little bit of a different way than I think writers who write only in realism do. Mm. Although maybe I shouldn't say that. I'm sure there are premises in their work that they also have to recommit to regularly.
And with this, you felt like it feels like you had to have some real belief.
Yes.
In the story.
That's the word.
Or in Adina's story.
That's the word. It was an exercise in belief, which is very fitting because the entire book is about belief. Whether or not you believe in Adina, whether or not you believe she is who she says she is, changes the shape of the book, and it changes the read of the book, and that I did deliberately. I baked in these ideas of belief, my own ideas, into the book so that the reader too had to participate with me to decide for themselves what the end truly meant.
So maybe if Beautyland had been easy for you, maybe that wouldn't be part of it.
I do notice that normally the hardest thing to do tends to be the right thing to do and what leads to at least the bravest expression. Yeah.
I feel like that's our PSA for the
Is it?
For
oh,
the
okay.
day. Yeah. People are like, I don't want to hear that right now. The hardest thing is
Oh, I'm really sorry.
Right
well, I mean, I'm yeah. sure you I'm hey, I think you probably already know.
I know. Yes. Yeah. Writing
is not, yeah.
I think Richard Hugo said writing is hard, and that's when I used to work at a place called Richard Hugo House. Then they tightened the name to Hugo House in Seattle, and mm-hmm. We had bookmarks that said writing is hard, Richard Hugo, and just left it there, you know, because I think in a way you have to, and there were other bookmarks with something that was perhaps more hopeful, but I feel like, honestly, it's yeah. good to say it too sometimes.
Writing is hard, but that's not all it is.
Exactly.
That's just one of the things. That's just one of many, many things that it is.
That's yeah. just one short assertion.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's take a short break, really short, and then we'll come back. Okay. Today on Living Writers, Marie-Helene Bertino is here. Her novel, Beautyland. I'm Dee Hetzel. We'll be back.
Of a wave, it's like magic.
person taking us back.
I know. It was hard to...
So good.
It was hard not to hear the whole bit.
I think Jason wanted it to keep going.
Yeah. So today on Living Writers, Marie-Helene Bertino is here. So DJ Marie, what did we just hear?
Well, you just heard ELO Livin' Thing, and that's from the year Adina was born, 1977. So that would have been playing when she was born in Northeast Regional Hospital at the same time that Voyager 1 spacecraft was launched out of Florida. I imagine that was playing that in Barracuda as Adina was born and Voyager 1 was launched.
And those things are present from the early moments mm-hmm. of Beautyland. And then also later on, Barracuda comes when Adina's walking down the street, sees a girl with her mother. Like there's these moments and threads with the...
A lot of callbacks.
Yes. Is that something that is you're consciously doing because of how you develop a character and their world? Is that...
Honestly, I actually think it's because I grew up obsessed with comedians. And another wonderful writer who I adore, Marissa Matarazzo, actually is the one who pointed out to me that I have a lot of callbacks in my work. She came to one of my readings, and afterwards she was like, I see you and your callbacks. Calling it back, girl. Good for you. And up until that point, I hadn't realized, oh, I do that. I like things that have memory. I like sitcoms that have memory. I like rewarding a reader's journey. I always think it's strange.
And that's in Beautyland. Like yes. Adina shares that feeling of yours.
That's right. You got me.
Well, no. No, but it's actually, it's really lovely, Marie. Thanks for talking about it because it connects to, like, I think one of the earliest things you said this conversation, which was, you know, as a writer, your lived emotional, your feelings, your lived experiences are present within the truth of the book, even mm-hmm. though it's a fictional, it's an imaginary creation and speculative.
Yeah. Maybe a little too much. More than I even realized. I mean, because I'll be talking and someone's like, right, that's literally a chapter in Parakeet. And I'll be like, what are you talking about? And you forget. You put it in and someone says, you know that you wrote that already in the book. So, yeah, sometimes you're a little bit too known on the page, I think. But, yes, the callbacks and comedians and I would have... Did you do this? I feel like a lot of people did this. I had whole monologues of comedians memorized, like Mitch Hedberg and SNL skits.
SNL for sure. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Did you grow up with it as well?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And even like paying tribute to like, I think it was sort of their first 25th anniversary show. I remember this is in the Wayback Machine, mm-hmm. but somebody having like a VHS tape or a VCR, like for a VCR mm-hmm. where you'd see that special with all. Oh, do you know Gildna Radner? Fun fact about WCBN. She was a weather girl here when she went to school here on WCBN.
No.
So there's like a little... thread.
Oh, I didn't even realize she went to school here. That is incredible.
But back to you with character development.
Let's talk about Gilda Radner. Let's talk about SNL. but yeah, so I loved, and I still love comedy. I still listen to it. And I don't just listen to it once. I listen to it over and over and over and over and over again. And I feel like those rhythms
the built space of and the rhythms.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. And I think that I sometimes when I think that I hear lines before I write them, I realize, oh, that's just the rhythm of that that punchline in that Mitch Hedberg routine that I, you know, have known for years. And I'm matching words to his rhythm because I know that they work because, you know, his delivery especially was always so good that every time you would hear them, you would laugh. So... yeah, I love that stuff.
When you're revising, when you're drafting, are you reading aloud too? Are you, because we were talking about sound to begin with, and Adina mm-hmm. has a quality where some sounds really affect her.
That's
like
right.
Someone swallowing or
yes, misophonia. Adina has misophonia and is really, really hyper aware of sound, and. Do I read it out loud when I write it? Yes, I do. I try to read it aloud as much as I can bear it. And I encourage my students to do the same and to hear other people read it too, if possible.
Oh, yeah. Why? Why is that important to you to hear it, someone else read it aloud?
I think that it reframes it. It resituates it. It allows you to hear things that you wouldn't normally hear and notice things that you wouldn't normally notice when it's taken out of what you're familiar with.
That's true, because then it's automatic distancing in some way.
Exactly. Like, I know writers who put their work into different fonts or have their computer read out the words to them just so they can hear it from a different perspective.
You know what? You mentioned that you're working on something else that will be coming down the pike in like a year.
Yeah.
Is it another novel? Or vignettes? Or what are you working on?
I'm so excited because I get to return to short stories, which I feel like are my first love. And so I have a collection coming out next year. It's called Exit Zero. And it has a female vampire who is stuck on the threshold of perimenopause. And
wow.
A really irritable unicorn, and lots of fun, cool things. I love stories so much, so it's going to be great fun to tour around with that, I hope,
next year. And what do you love? Because the short story, the story is such a different beast from the novel.
Yeah.
And so what is it about working in the story again that you love? Because it's clear that you love that.
Yeah. Well, when I was in an MFA, I was writing stories and I didn't think I would ever be able to write a novel. And then the short story sound is the sound I heard first when I was with the Blackout Writers Group. And I just thought, oh, this is the sound I love and I'll never be able to hear the sound of the novel. And then I figured my own way out into the novel that I could handle. And then I worried that I would never hear the sound of the short story again. And it's still actually a little bit hard. I'm a little bit rusty and I don't know, to be honest, if I'll ever hear it as purely as I did back then when I first fell in love with it. I don't know. Oh, your face.
I know. Because like you said, you're different. Like, you know different things, or you feel in the sound. Maybe the sound you're looking for will be different.
I guess so. I hope so. I hope that I can keeping the discovery aspect in the process is something that I'm always working on, whether it's stories or the novel. So, you know, I'll just keep going.
Thank you, Marie.
Thank you, T.
And
what a delight.
Oh, thank you. Marie Helene Bertino, her novel Beautyland will be reading and tomorrow at the Helmut Stern Auditorium in UMA, part of the Zell Visiting Writers series. Marie, thanks so much for today.
Thank you.
Thanks to Jason for engineering. Thanks to all you out there listening. Hi, Mom. Until next time.
Hi, T's Mom.
Hello, you are listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. It is 6 o'clock, which means it is time for the Daily Sports Report. I'm Alex Miller. We've got a full crew Once again, on today's DSR, I'm joined by Theo Chernoff, Perry Mortzinos, Bowen Dang, Chanel Champagne. How we doing, folks?
Good.
Doing great. Hey, doing
good
great.
To be here again.
Yeah, so this is a fun panel. Some newer members. Bowen's the other vet with me, and this should be fun. Bit of a potpourri today. Mix it up. Try to go around the horn a little bit. But we're going to start with the MLB. Playoffs are around the corner. We're in the middle of September. A lot of interesting baseball on the precipice. What teams do you guys root for that you're looking at right now?
I'm a Phillies fan, so I'm feeling pretty good right now.
I am a Mariners fan, and I am disappointed.
Big Yankees fan.
And then I'm a Red Sox fan, but I'm kind of in the same boat as Theo, a little disappointed with how the year's gone so far.
Yeah, so I'm a Tigers fan, and Detroit's playing some interesting baseball right now. So wild card race close in the AL. Barry, your Red Sox are in there with me. And sorry, we're doing some behind the scenes. We just got into the studio post Living Writers. That mic is dead. Could you pass Chanel a different microphone? Two doesn't work. So anyway, we're getting situated. But back to the world of baseball. So the Tigers, for one, have been playing interesting baseball. They've got the Rockies right now. Kyder Montero last night pitched a gem, a Maddox, if you want to call it that. 96 pitches.